Hello, Audio Journal listeners. In place of our regularly scheduled programming, we bring you the following program brought to you by Audio Journal.
This program is intended for a print impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Welcome to the Massachusetts State House News Service, providing our listeners with high quality, comprehensive, objective information about the activities of our state government. Today, we are covering the week of June 8th through 14th, 2026. This program is sponsored by the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind. This is Paula Simchak. The new chairman of Cannabis Control Commission is focused on clearing the air within the agency that has been plagued with internal conflicts. Chris Harding, who Governor Maura Healey tapped to lead the CCC in May, said during a meeting Thursday that his priorities for the role include engaging with staff and understanding their focuses, as well as the agency's organizational challenges and opportunities. Thanking staff for their engagement, Harding also noted that he plans to work closely on the organizational design with Executive Director Travis Ahern, who has had headline-grabbing clashes with former CCC Chair Shannon O'Brien. It's time of change like this like presents an opportunity to say, are there things we can do differently or better this internally in the agency? This is critically important because the work that we do here internally helps support all the things we do externally, Harding said. So I think we have a real opportunity there. Harding said he's also focused on engaging businesses, consumers, patients, and lawmakers. In making recommendations, Harding said he follows the acronym SEETS, S-E-E-T-S, which stands for Safe, Equitable, Efficient, Transparent, and Sustainable. He added that sustainability is a topic he's interested in learning more about within the state's cannabis industry. Cannabis businesses have been struggling to stay afloat amid dropping marijuana prices, and Harding pointed out commissioners had taken up a slew of change of ownership applications during its last meeting. When you start a new industry, you kind of go through some of that irrational exuberance, and it grows on a curve, and then it matures and it settles. Okay, what can we as an agency and we as regulators do to help support the sustainability of this for the medium-long term, he said. Commissioner Anthony Wilson, who recently advised cannabis businesses, noted that many in the industry have been concerned and frustrated with the CCC. He also praised CCC staff, saying they were aware of the concerns and have been working on some of the issues internally. I'm confident that the public will see some of these things being addressed in the up-and-coming year and going further, he said. Wilson said he is focused on regulations that support public health and safety, as well as the strength of the industry. This includes ensuring safe and well-tested products, keeping marijuana away from minors, and boosting trust among consumers and businesses. Also, Wilson said he wants to address inversion, which is when illegal out-of-state marijuana products enter the legal market. For too long, this business has been treated as if it shouldn't exist. But this is a legal industry in the state of Massachusetts, as approved by more than 60% of voters. I tend to treat it that way, he said. Commissioner Xiomara de Lobato said she is prioritizing thoughtful and equitable implementation of the framework for cannabis consumption in social settings, as well as social equity programs beyond the pre-licensing stages. Also, de Lobato said she wants the CCC to be a strong thought partner with cities and towns and communities. A lot of my focus is going to be ensuring that we, as an agency, believe in walking the walk, that social equity, social justice, responsible regulation, economic growth can and must move forward together in the work that we do, she said. Under the law, commissioners have until Friday, June 19th, to promulgate regulations for new policies, including raising the cap on the number of licenses cannabis retailers can hold from 3 store licenses to 6. Commissioners adopted a motion Thursday tasking the legal department to present a set of emergency regulations during its next meeting that's scheduled for June 17th. Commissioners also voted to shift license renewal authority from the board to the executive director. Ahern, who pitched the idea, noted that the executive director would report to the board on license renewals, and the CCC can still take up any questions or concerns surrounding the renewal during a meeting. This process took place during the month-long gap where there was no CCC after the previous board dissolved with the new cannabis law and before new commissioners were appointed, Ahern said. He added that some license categories that are less ministerial would remain under the board's authority. Healthcare entities flagged for not hitting a newly proposed primary care spending target and failing to make improvements could be hit with hefty financial penalties under legislation that emerged in the Senate Thursday. The late session push to gradually fortify a key sector is also raising fresh questions around cost control and affordability. Unveiled after Senate President Karen Spilka spoke to business leaders about it at a Boston hotel, the legislation envisions pumping potentially billions of dollars into the primary care sector without raising already surging medical spending. Although Spilka emphasized the branch's focus on affordability, the legislation does not offer a concrete roadmap for how to redistribute health dollars while ensuring patients are not faced with new cost pressures that may force them to forego care. By a 14-0 vote, the Senate Ways and Means Committee advanced a primary care reform package that features a phased-in spending target for the sector and standardized capitated payment model that replaces a traditional fee-for-service structure. The bill, based closely on recommendations from a primary care task force, is up for a vote next Thursday. Promised by Spilka more than 17 months ago, the bill looks to boost access to primary care, grow the shrinking workforce, and give new enforcement powers to the Health Policy Commission. The House has not proposed its own version of the bill, but under new rules, the topic can remain in plan all year if the branches each approve bills and get them to a negotiating panel. The proposed reimbursement overhaul applies to commercial insurers and the Group Insurance Commission that would pay providers with respective per-member, per-month lump sums. Insurers and the GIC would be blocked from imposing prior authorization requirements on primary care services under the payment model. In a bid for insurance parity, the bill stipulates commercial insurers cannot reimburse community health centers, where many people access primary care services at a lower rate than MassHealth. Senator Sidney Friedman, the chamber's healthcare point person, told the news service that insurers like some of the bill, but don't like certain provisions. They like the fact that if they're going to do this, if they're going to be required to do this, that the providers are required to pick it up, because you need a critical mass of movement in order for it to be successful, Friedman said. They don't like the fact that we are setting a standard across the board. They want to be able to do their thing. The Arlington Democrat added, the systems don't like the shifting of money. They don't like that they're going to be held accountable for shifting dollars because they'll say we're in bad shape. Friedman pledged all stakeholders would have a seat at the table as the payment model is hashed out. Laura Pellegrini, CEO of the Massachusetts Association of Health Plans, said the Ways and Means proposal will end up raising costs for employers, consumers, and purchasers of insurance. While the association supports efforts to strengthen the primary care sector, Pellegrini, she's concerned the bill lacks a clear mechanism to ensure new investments can be made without increasing overall health care costs, health insurance premiums, or member cost sharing. At a time when Massachusetts continues to face significant affordability challenges, any proposal that requires substantial new spending should be accompanied by a realistic and achievable framework for offsetting those costs elsewhere in the system, Pellegrini continued. Under the bill, the HPC is tasked with setting and enforcing the primary care spending target for the overall system and individual entities. In 2028, the bill calls for 9% of total health care spending to be dedicated to primary care. That percentage would climb to 12% in 2029 and 15% in 2030. In 2031 and beyond, the targets cannot be lower than 15%, according to a Ways and Means summary. Total healthcare spending in 2024 was $83.3 billion, according to the most recent data from the Center for Health Information and Analysis. Under a 15% target, primary care spending would need to be around $12.5 billion. Former Governor Charlie Baker tried to get Massachusetts to set a primary care spending target back in 2018, as he also sought to drive investments in addiction services, behavioral health, and geriatric services. In 2024, primary care accounted for 8.4% of total spending at MassHealth, according to a dashboard released Thursday by the Center for Health Information and Analysis and Massachusetts Health Quality Partners. That compares to 6.6% for commercial insurers and 4.2% for Medicare Advantage. While total spending on primary care services for commercial members increased from $1.8 billion to $2.0 billion in 2025, spending on other services outpaced that of primary care, resulting in a decline in the proportion of primary care spending, the dashboard says. Under the Senate bill, the HPC must notify healthcare entities that fail to reach the primary care spending target. Entities would also be flagged if their heightened investment in primary care prompts a jump in overall medical spending, or if there's an increase to premiums or cost sharing. The agency is also empowered to put violators on a performance improvement plan. The HPC could levy escalating penalties starting at $500,000 for entities that neglect to file an improvement plan on time, fail to find a plan in good faith with the commission, fail to implement the plan in good faith, or knowingly failed to provide and knowingly falsified information, according to the legislation. A second violation comes with a penalty of up to $750,000, and subsequent penalties could not be more than the amount by which the healthcare entity failed to meet the primary care expenditure target. The HPC could also block entities from accepting new patients, according to a Senate fact sheet. The HPC would become home to the new Office of Primary Care Policy and Payment, which is charged with establishing the standardized primary care capitated payment model. Also known as the Advanced Primary Care Payment Model, the structure would include guidelines on which services are covered, per member, per month rate methodology, reimbursement and spending reporting requirements, audits of participating providers and organizations, and limits or bans on cost sharing, among other provisions. A Primary Care Technical Advisory Council would help the new HPC office develop the model. All providers and provider organizations that are registered with the HPC would need to embrace the payment model. Those providers, aside from participating independent primary care practices, also need to file reports and comply with audits that the new HPC office may require. Pellegrini said she's concerned commercial insurers would be subject to new payment structures modeled after Medicaid programs. The framework risks increasing costs, limiting flexibility, and disrupting existing value-based payment arrangements and innovative care delivery models, she said. After its expected passage in the Senate next week, the primary care bill heads to the House, and Friedman said she's been very communicative with her Health Care Financing Committee co-chair, Representative John Lawn. He knows it's coming, Friedman said. He knows what's in it. Governor Maura Healey's Healthcare Affordability Work Group is also expected to produce initial recommendations by the end of June. Health regulators reiterated their uncertainty about the scope of primary care services that Mass General Brigham and CVS MinuteClinic could deliver as they released a finalized report Thursday that advances this pending partnership while incorporating new stipulations on care delivery. After initiating a rare probe in September of the clinical affiliation that's poised to transform 37 MinuteClinic sites into primary care clinics, the Health Policy Commission Board voted to release the final cost and market impact review. The movement came as the Senate released a primary care reform bill to pump significantly more money into the sector and expand the workforce. Regulators have been intrigued about the prospect of an innovative care model to expand primary care access, but the sticker shock continues to linger, and the HPC said Thursday it remains uncertain whether or when MinuteClinic will provide comprehensive, high-quality primary care. The affiliation comes with some limitations, such as MinuteClinic not providing oral health screenings, prescribing controlled substances, and offering telehealth visits initially. The arrangement is expected to deliver primary care to tens of thousands of adults and scale back MinuteClinic's existing menu of convenience care offerings like flu shots and vaccines. Pediatric primary care is not included in the model. The HPC initially estimated the affiliation would raise commercial healthcare spending by $40.2 million. CVS and MGB argued the HPC's analysis made a fundamental statistical error and that the cost impact should be between $13.8 million to $22.3 million. In their response, the party said Massachusetts is facing a deepening primary care shortage. While this approach may not satisfy every view of what primary care expansion ought to entail, continued inaction risks exacerbating access challenges that the existing delivery system has thus far been unable to solve, CVS and MGB said. The HPC on Thursday trimmed its cost impact estimate to $39.9 million, with the figure still largely stemming from CVS patients receiving primary care at significantly higher MGB prices. The transaction cannot be finalized for 30 days, according to the HPC. The final report is being shipped to the Department of Public Health, where the affiliation is not subject to a determination of need request, but will need clinic licensure approvals, an HPC spokesperson said. The report is also headed to Attorney General Andrea Campbell's office, which has separate authority to monitor the healthcare market, the HPC said. MinuteClinic also agreed to new conditions and reporting requirements with the HPC. That includes the parties exploring ways to mitigate costs, like incrementally phasing in MinuteClinic advanced practice providers into MGB's contracted rate scheduled over 2 years. Primary care faces increasing challenges in Massachusetts, and our residents continue to face mounting pressure related to healthcare affordability and access, HPC Executive Director David Seltz said. As we seek to test out innovative solutions, we must continue to balance the need for primary care with the need to improve affordability of this care. As it gradually transforms its locations and seeks full clinic licensure from DPH to deliver primary care, MinuteClinic pledged to prioritize sites that have the greatest unmet need, based on the HPC's assessment. MinuteClinic also plans to develop and implement an outreach plan for MassHealth patients and other undeserved populations, the HPC said. MinuteClinic previously planned to discontinue convenience care for children, but it now intends to keep the service. The DPH confirmed that MinuteClinic can receive full clinic licensure to provide convenience care to both adults and children, the HPC said. As the HPC monitors the primary care rollout, the agency attached new reporting requirements around the number of MinuteClinic advanced practice providers and other clinicians who have joined MGB contracts, MinuteClinic prices and increases for commercial insurers, a list of sites that receive full clinic licensure each year, the patient payer mix, the annual volume of primary care and convenience care visits, and the annual volume of specialty referrals. The HPC also wants to know MinuteClinic's progress in joining MGB's accountable care organization and whether more services, particularly telehealth, oral health screenings, and full behavioral health screenings and medication management, have been added. We appreciate the collaboration of the parties during this review and public accountability process, as well as their pledge of continued partnership with the HPC, HPC Board Chair Deborah DeVoe said. Governor Maura Healey on Friday signed a $1.56 billion transportation and education spending bill and legislation updating disability-related language in state law. The supplemental budget directs surplus revenue generated by the surtax on wealthier households toward major investments in the MBTA, special education reimbursements, child care, and relief from the cost of clearing municipal roads this winter. Healey also approved a separate bill replacing hundreds of outdated references to people with disabilities in Massachusetts statutes, culminating a legislative effort that supporters said stretched more than two decades. The spending package marks another major deployment of revenue generated by the voter-approved constitutional amendment imposing an additional 4% tax on an annual income above $1 million. The new tax continues to spin off large amounts of revenue for education and transportation, while other areas of state spending are dependent on slower-growing tax revenue sources. The law appropriates roughly $1.35 billion in surtax revenue, including about $780 million for transportation and $574 million for education initiatives. The compromise emerged from weeks of negotiations between House and Senate leaders who had differed on how heavily the money should be concentrated on MBTA investments versus broader regional transportation and education priorities. The largest single investment is $595.5 million for the MBTA. The funding is intended to rebuild operating reserves, support infrastructure improvements, expand low-income fare discounts, and bolster workforce and safety initiatives. The package also provides $35 million for regional transit authorities and $5 million for grants supporting microtransit and last-mile transportation services. Municipal leaders had closely watched negotiations because of a proposed snow and ice relief program after a winter marked by severe storms. The law makes about $101 million available to cities and towns to offset winter maintenance expenses. Education spending includes $152 million for special education and circuit breaker reimbursements, a priority for local officials facing growing special education costs. The package also dedicates $150 million to early education and care initiatives, including funding aimed at reducing wait lists for child care assistance and supporting educator loan forgiveness programs. Lawmakers included $40 million for literacy efforts, evenly split between the administration's Literacy Launch Initiative and tutoring programs. Additional education investments include $18.3 million in higher education financial aid, funding for regionalization and shared service initiatives, and $10 million for a primary care physician scholarship program. The law also provides $207.7 million in general fund supplemental appropriations to address fiscal 2026 budget pressures. Major allocations include $54.4 million for sheriff's offices, $41.7 million for Department of Transitional Assistance Staffing, $31 million for Department of Correction Operations, $20 million for home heating assistance, and $10 million for the World Cup, held in Foxborough this summer. Negotiators used the bill to settle a tax policy dispute that emerged after a 2025 federal law altered portions of the tax code to which Massachusetts automatically conforms. Administration officials had warned that without legislative action, the federal changes could reduce state tax collections by roughly $442 million in the current fiscal year and more than $250 million annually thereafter. Under the compromise, Massachusetts will phase in several federal tax changes over multiple years. The law also includes a mechanism that pauses certain conformity provisions if voters approve a November ballot question that would reduce the state's income tax rate from 5% to 4%. The law also includes a new sales tax exemption for building materials used in approved multifamily housing developments. Lawmakers said the measure is intended to lower construction costs and encourage housing production. The law also establishes tax incentives tied to sustainable aviation fuel and food donations by farmers. Representative Jay Livingstone said the disability language proposal had been under consideration for 22 years as legislators and advocates worked to identify outdated language throughout state law and ensure revisions would not unintentionally affect eligibility for programs or services. The new law updates hundreds of references in Massachusetts statutes, replacing terms such as mentally retarded and handicapped with person with an intellectual or developmental disability, and replacing references to a disabled person with person with a disability. It also removes other terminology that advocates say stigmatizes people by defining them primarily through their disabilities. The enacted law does not alter eligibility standards, benefits, or services. Supporters said it instead modernizes state statutes to reflect contemporary language and person-first terminology. Senator Patricia Gillen, who spent years sponsoring versions of the legislation, said during debate last year that language evolves over time and people should be called by the words that are respectful to them. With Healy Signature Friday, advocates for people with disabilities celebrated what they described as a long-awaited statutory update, while administration officials highlighted the measure as part of broader efforts to promote inclusion and accessibility across state government. The initiative petition that would undo the 2016 legalization of recreational marijuana can continue advancing toward November's ballot, the state's highest court said Friday in a ruling that also deemed the Attorney General's summary of the question to be fair. A handful of participants in the state program that provides funding to boost opportunities for entrepreneurs disproportionately impacted by marijuana prohibition and enforcement filed a lawsuit seeking to remove the question from this year's ballot. The plaintiffs argued that Attorney General Andrea Campbell's required summary of the initiative left out key details and that the AG should not have certified the multifaceted measure because it contains unrelated policy sections. The Supreme Judicial Court disagreed in a 20-page opinion written by Justice Bessie DeWar. The Attorney General argues that the petition's various parts all relate to the common purpose of restricting the use of recreational marijuana through a new integrated scheme for marijuana regulation. We agree and are not persuaded by the plaintiff's arguments to the contrary, the jurist appointed by Governor Maura Healey, an opponent of 2016's legalization, wrote. Elsewhere in the ruling, DeWar wrote, "We conclude that the Attorney General did not err in certifying the petition on either of the claimed grounds, and that her summary of the petition is fair." Massachusetts voters legalized recreational cannabis through a 2016 ballot measure. The Coalition for a Healthy Massachusetts is advancing this year's ballot question, which would repeal legalization of non-medical marijuana, allow adults 21 or older to possess and gift up to an ounce of marijuana, possession of up to second ounce would carry a civil penalty, make it a civil infraction for people younger than 21 to possess up to 2 ounces, and allow retail marijuana stores to either apply or become medical dispensaries or sell their inventory to one. The Cannabis Control Commission would remain, but only to regulate the medical sector. Massachusetts is just not as comfortable a place to live in anymore. We walk across the common and smell weed. I drive down Interstate 93. The car in front of me is a hot box. It's everywhere. It's pervasive. Wendy Wakeman, a veteran of Republican Party politics, who is working as spokeswoman for the ballot campaign, told lawmakers in March. The legislature's Special Joint Committee on Initiative Petitions recommended that lawmakers take no action on the idea this spring, and most members of the committee signed on to a report that details tax revenue, public health, and public safety concerns with the idea. The committee finds that the proposal lacks sufficient detail regarding implementation and enforcement mechanisms, including how existing regulatory authority would be modified, transferred, or eliminated. This absence of clarity creates legal uncertainty with respect to the continued applicability of current statutes and regulations, as well as the rules of state agencies responsible for oversight of the cannabis industry, the report said. It added, the majority of the committee therefore finds that, as drafted, the proposal does not adequately address these operational, fiscal, and public safety considerations. Legal cannabis sales grossed more than $1.65 billion in 2025 and generated $289 million in state tax revenue in fiscal year 2025, according to the CCC. Early education officials are pushing state budget negotiators to restore funding for agency operations and two programs eliminated under the Senate spending bill. Speaking during Strategies for Children's weekly 9:30 call, Early Education and Care Commissioner Amy Kershaw said Thursday that the administration is focused on restoring funding for the Department of Early Education and Care's administrative account, Career Pathways, and Reach Out and Read, as House and Senate negotiators work toward an agreement on a new state budget for the fiscal year that begins July 1. The House and the Senate are now in conference committee, and there are a couple key watch areas for the Department of Early Education and Care, Kershaw said. The top issue is differences in our administrative line item that we're very focused on, trying to make sure that we are restored to fiscal 25 levels, which is what was in the House budget that would allow us to support existing operations, including staff and many of our IT modernization efforts. The department's line item was funded at $27.7 million in fiscal 2025. Governor Maura Healey proposed $13.2 million for fiscal 2027. The House recommended $20.3 million, and the Senate proposed $9.7 million. Roughly $2 million below the account's fiscal 2026 level of $11.5 million. The Senate was proud to go big on early education and care in its fiscal year 27 budget, increasing EEC spending by 9.7% over the fiscal year 26 budget. Our fiscal year 27 budget is laser-focused on affordability for families seeking support for early education and care services, increasing direct support to families through child care financial assistance by $255 million over fiscal year 26. Senate Ways and Means Committee spokesman Sean Fitzgerald said. The committee said the department received $45.5 million in a surplus surtax supplemental budget last year for capacity building. Kershaw also highlighted two programs that were eliminated entirely from the Senate budget, but funded by both the governor and House in their versions of the budget. Our Career Pathways program, which is serving nearly 4,000 educators across the state, is a unique opportunity to really create a pathway into higher education. And we don't have another program like that across the state, Kershaw said. The Career Pathways program received $3 million in fiscal 2026. Healey and the House each proposed $2.97 million for fiscal 2027, while the Senate omitted the line item. The program provides grant-funded education, coursework, textbooks, tutoring, and other supports that help early education and out-of-school time educators earn credentials needed to become teachers and program directors. The Senate Ways and Means Committee said this program is effectively moot since the state began funding free community college. Kershaw said the Senate also eliminated Reach Out and Read, an early literacy initiative funded at $1.75 million in fiscal 2026. Both the governor and House maintained that funding level. Kershaw said the funding goes to 250 community health centers to provide books and early literacy materials to young children. The funding debate comes amid several years of major state investment in early education and care. Since 2023, lawmakers and the Healey administration have directed hundreds of millions of dollars into the sector through Commonwealth Cares for Children, C3, stabilization grants, provider rate increases, and expanded child care assistance. Early education advocates have pointed to Massachusetts as one of the few states that continued major stabilization funding after federal pandemic relief dollars expired. Healey's fiscal 2027 budget proposes more than $1.8 billion for the sector. House Speaker Ron Mariano's office said the House spending plan reflects that commitment. The House has long championed funding for early education and care, included by targeting support to the EEC workforce and by making historic investments to increase access, quality, and affordability for families, Mariano said in a statement. Kershaw also pointed Thursday to a supplemental budget now awaiting Healey's signature that includes $38.7 million aimed at reducing the state's child care financial assistance wait list. If that is signed, we do think there would be an opportunity for the first time since 2024 to really open access, especially for our educators working in childcare and early education programs, she said. The spending bill directs $38.7 million toward reducing the wait list for income-eligible early education and care programs. The package includes at least $7.7 million for newly procured early education slots, $8 million to help educators pay for their own child care, and $7.5 million for a newly established early educator loan forgiveness program. You've been listening to an episode of the Massachusetts State House News Service, a program produced by Audio Journal and sponsored by the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind. This is Paula Simchak. Thank you for listening. Stay tuned for more informative programming by Audio Journal.
You are listening to Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.